What's up?
Hey, folks, Jerry here. Welcome to the Pioneers of Insight podcast, a show that explores the wipeouts, crackups, and recoveries of inspiring and influential people. Here you'll get the stories of the quest to find success beyond the struggle and the great leaps of innovation that take us there. People that sound like this.
JLD.
What's up,
Jerry?
What's up, man? What's up, brother?
Thank you so much.
Well, I'm excited to be here, Jerry. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Fun today.
Keep telling your story as well.
Yeah, man.
Hey, John.
Hi.
How you doing? Sorry, I'm a couple minutes late here. I was vlogging.
No problem.
Lost my brain for a minute.
Today, we deep dive the life story of John Rasmussen, who left the fast-paced world of Silicon Valley to become a shaman. All right, strap in, folks, as we head into a story about letting go of expectations and following a calling. Enjoy part one of this two-part episode, and I will catch you on the other side.
I get it. Yeah, man. I'm excited. Let's do it. You know, as opposed to, I don't know, I gotta go away for a year. You know what the hell you
John Rasmussen, welcome back to the Pioneers of Insight podcast. Happy to have you here.
It's great to be back, Jerry. Thank you.
Yes, we had a little bit of conversation before we got started. I was lucky enough to have a conversation with you about 3 years ago, and we were already starting to talk about the changes in our lives and maybe even what the seeming lack of change as well as the reality of that. So what I like to do with our listeners is to give everybody an opportunity to really get a first person perspective of how each guest sees themselves in what they do. That to me seems way more valuable than inviting somebody to give their resume and check off boxes in terms of how they want to appear to the world. So I'm going to ask you the question to get us started in the interview. How do you see what you do each day? How do you look at what you do each day?
Well, I would say that, there's something a bit unique about the shamanic training that gets us as much personally out of the way as possible. And it's always been a bit of my nature anyway, the sort of observer and witness. And so I see myself, you know, basically showing up when I'm asked to the extent that I can logistically, and making myself and you know, the training and everything that I've had available to what's being presented. And so being a very sort of blank slate in that way, even if I have worked on somebody several times, this next time that they come to me, I have no sort of pre-knowledge or assumptions. I don't hold any of my sort of previous work such that I want to be completely present in the moment with what is happening exactly in that moment. Mm-hmm. And so, so that's what it is. It's very much an emptiness in a way.
So let's just dive into the practicality of it just a little bit. Mm-hmm. If I was to dial up your mom on the phone right now, what would she say you do each every day?
help people, you know, advise people and heal people and, you know, work with spirit to do all of that.
Yeah, so mom sees the healer. Mm-hmm. What else are we missing? What else do you think the listener needs to know about you before we kind of get into your background and your experiences in terms of your own wake-up calls and things of that nature?
So the classic definition of the shaman, the mediator of souls between the worlds, and what that means is, you know, in addition to being the witness, you're sort of an advocate, you know, to spirit for the person. And you're calling on a team, you're calling on whatever forces of nature can come and have an influence on the healing process or the teaching process. And in that, there's a requirement as well to be completely non-judging, completely unoffendable, and unattached. Mm-hmm. So that's my challenge as a man and a healer. That's what I do.
Well, I'm going to ask you about that in terms of how you maintain a practice of staying in touch with spirit.
Right.
And I think this is a good way to segue into the next phase of the interview, which is really understanding how you started to get a sense of what your mission in life was.
Right.
Oftentimes, in a healer's journey, and in many just typical life journeys, we run into challenges in our lives or low points where we start to get a sense that maybe I'm uncomfortable with where I'm at and maybe there's more to this thing called life. Did you have a moment in your own life where you could call it a bottom, where light started to turn on for you, and what was going on in your life at that time?
Sure. I'll start by saying that what I've learned over the years is that there's an easy way and a hard way to do everything. Uh-huh. Okay. The hard way is usually what happens when you don't deliberately allow the easy way. Mm-hmm. And I would say that connecting with spirit, like, you know, our sort of default, our natural default as healthy human beings, you might say, would be that spirit makes it super easy. Nature itself makes it really easy for us if we just allow it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I didn't know that as I was growing up. I was under the myths and the beliefs of, you know, life's a struggle. Life's
and
a struggle
that way.
And it's hard, you know, you got to work hard and, mm-hmm. Otherwise it's not worth it. And so, you know, I worked really hard in school and I worked really hard at just trying to be 110% human. You know, I had this strange approach to life of you got to be as smart as you can be, and you got to be work as hard as you can be. I started working, you know, at a very early age, every chance I could get. I worked out and exercised, tried to make my body perfect, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I struggled therefore with relationships more than anything, because there's there's other people in the world, and there is a huge diversity of beliefs and approaches. And if you think you've got the one, then you're in for trouble. And so, you know, I struggled with that for many years, and I had good sort of mentors, or at least one good mentor that was a psychologist and a friend of mine that helped me a bit with that stuff. But
well, let me tease this out just a little bit so we can keep the listener on track with you. So early on, there was a message that life for you was a struggle. This is a popular message that's out there, but for you, you took that on pretty seriously, right?
Yeah.
And you leaned into life. I hear that there was, it sounds like there's an achiever in you. There was like, an internal mantra or a message that's playing that's saying, I got to be better. I got to do more. I got to da da da.
That kind of message. The purpose of life. Yeah.
Right, right. So let me ask you, where, I'm going to pull the camera back just a little bit. Where do you think that message came for you? Because I know often when I have these interviews, if I pull the camera back, our beliefs come from somewhere, right? We're human beings and we pick them up from somewhere. And oftentimes it's family.
Yeah.
So was this stuff coming from your family at that time or other powerful mentors in your life or just media or culture? Where were you getting this?
It was, I have two older brothers, high achievers, right? Very you know, in athletic and academics, and I think probably driven a bit by my parents as well, originally, right? But I'd say my oldest brother was really the one that I noticed and looked to and listened to. He was the sergeant, so to speak. He was the one telling me what I should do. And, you know, and there's things about both of my brothers that really impressed me. And I just, I figured that's the deal. Like, that's what you got to do, you know.
So less your parents, but more your siblings. They became kind of models for this striving to achieve type thing.
Yes.
You're a third born.
Yes.
Okay. So two older brothers, powerful figures in your life. You took it seriously and you started, sounds like, grinding pretty early in life, right?
Yes, very much okay. So
take us to where that started to change, or where maybe the wake-up call started to happen for you in terms of a low point where the heat started to get turned up in life, where you maybe looked at that a little bit.
Interestingly enough, it came from the advice of this friend of mine that was a psychologist who actually was going to school with my older brother, college, and studying. And he decided to do his master's thesis and ultimately his doctorate on the adolescent male and used me as his subject. Hmm. So, because I was this bizarre young man.
So you raised your hand.
You know,
like, I'll do this. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and that sort of the conclusion of his paper, as I read it, was that, yeah, if John continues this, you know, Spartan existence and does not, you know, learn to socialize himself, he's going to be, you know, a mess. I can't remember his exact wording, but it was going to be a problem.
Right.
And of course, by the same, well, I can't allow that. You know, I've got to be perfect at that, too.
Right.
I can't let that happen. And so I went to college, 17, you know, at that point.
So you went pretty early, 17 years old.
Yeah.
In college. And,
I was, as a young student, I mean, it could have been even early. I was really accelerating and all that stuff and only kind of got pulled back because of the system. But anyway, I got in there and decided, okay, I'm gonna let go of all of the sort of, you know, exercise regimen, eating regimen, all these sort of things. And even my studies were sort of like, yeah, I'm not gonna. And I, you know, decided, okay, I'm gonna let go of all of the sort of, you know, exercise regimen, eating regimen, all these sort of things. And even my studies were sort of like, yeah, I'm not gonna. And I, you know, fell in love, right? And met a girl, you know, sort of, had sort of relationships in high school and that, but again, it wasn't, you know, they weren't the priority, right? Because I was too busy being, you know, this Spartan type thing. And
so maybe it was the first time you allowed yourself to fall in love.
Oh, yeah. And I fell, and it was brutal. I mean, it was a challenging relationship in terms of the sort of me being a caretaker. There were a lot of issues going on. And then these feelings and everything, and I just, and being sort of the sensitive person that I was to begin with, not knowing it yet, right? But being this really sensitive, you know, shaman type boy, right? Mm-hmm. It was a lot. And I hit, you know, I hit those really, really low points, right? Of like just,
So let's slow this down so the listener can really hear what's going on. So the first time you really kind of give up control and you allow yourself to let somebody else in, you fall into that relationship, right?
Yeah.
On the other side of it was pain when it didn't work out well. But your tendency that came from your own upbringing that I hear already is the ultimate achiever, is the high achiever. They never turn and point the finger outward. They turn it inward, right?
Always, yeah.
You're already a super sensitive soul. So you're persecuting yourself at the same time.
Yeah, that's sort of the tendency, both the achiever and the sensitive
right. person, right?
They don't ever want to be the one who causes the hurt. They don't right. mind being hurt so much, but if it looks like they cause the hurt, it's devastating. And that was true for me, and still kind of true for me on a lot of levels. But
Hey, me too.
Right?
Yeah. That's the gift and also the challenge of being the sensitive. Yeah.
Yeah. So 6 years in college and basically going through all that stuff. And
so where did you go at that time? I want to give the listeners a sense of where healers go early in life before they really get their wake-up call, where their tendency to go for support is. So at a time when you're struggling early, where did you start to look for support?
Okay, well, you know, books. You know, my mom sent me a book somewhere in there. Maybe I was 20 or so by then, 3 years into it or so. And it was, you know, I think Bridge Across Forever or something by Richard Bach. But it was profound, and it was beautiful, and it started to speak to, you know, that part of me that I didn't know much about before. You know, of the world of spirit. Yes, by the time I got out of college, you know, I was really, really diving into the sort of, you know, the Carlos Castaneda type works and, you know, the meditation and Yogananda's material and the Self-Realization Fellowship. And so that's where I went. I didn't have like I didn't really have a mentor at that point. Mm-hmm. I didn't reach out to my
you went inside, but there's something that's important also that I hear showing up. Your family had a language of spirit already, because the ladder that you were given at that time was a spiritual piece, right? It was the work of somebody that was spiritual.
Yeah, no, my mom was amazing in that regard. My mom was just, you know, was staunch Catholic, and that's how I was raised, but she did it in the way that was the mystic. Mm-hmm. You know, she really did it, and she really understood, and it saved her from breast cancer, I think, when I was about 4, and you know, other things like that. And so she was really an influence.
So in college, you're moving out of this relationship. You fall. Your ladder up is you're starting to dig into the works of the greats, the master spiritual teachers.
Yes.
And you're gaining a sense of yourself through that, it sounds like. Does it sound like I'm hearing you right?
Oh, totally. And I minored in English literature on top of it. I studied not only the sort of spiritual classics, but the classics, you know, the Shakespeare,
the great greats. Yep.
Carlyle and the Emersons and all that stuff. So it was, I loved it.
So you're feeding your inner shaman. That's what I hear.
Yeah.
Where would you say was the moment that you said, oh, God, there's something bigger to this, and there's something bigger to my role in life? Where do you think your wake-up call was? Because I hear you moving out as a young man into the world. You had a crisis. You had a sense of where some light is coming in. But where did the light really turn on? Was there one moment where you got a sense of the spiritual reality and your role in life?
You know, interestingly enough, like early on in my life, I had these, you know, these sort of near-death experiences, which one would think would have been the thing. And then I did have like this sort of Shaktipat type experience as a teen that was profound. My head exploded, light, someone was in the room, you know, but I kind of dismissed all that.
Well, don't dismiss it here, please.
No, I know.
So I want to do, this is
no,
where
I mean,
the
pod, these death experiences.
So here, which one do you feel is most powerful?
Well, probably that that Shakti Pot one because I was older. Because the earlier ones, I sort of, again, I just sort of like dismissed pretty quickly and put it aside because I didn't see a place for it right where I was.
Didn't have a frame, yeah.
I didn't have a frame, and I didn't have anyone that would understand or anything like that, so I just sort of shut it down. Then I had this other one, and it was more along when I was kind of like in my discipline phase, and so it was strange, and I didn't really have that much context for it at the time either, because I hadn't started really reading, you know, these materials, right? I just had this experience. So I want to just throw that in there because those might be other people's like profound calls. That was not mine. But they were there. They were in my field, you know. It's, you know, unconsciously, I guess, at that point. And then
so if you could explain to the listener, just in terms of the how you packaged that. If you said that's not your awakening experience, I'm not going to get into the story behind it, but I want to get a sense of what you did with it. So you had these powerful moments where maybe others might go, oh, there's definitely something, a greater awareness or a bigger piece to life. How did you package that? Which box did you put it in, those experiences in?
That's a great question. I think what I really did was just dismiss. I just moved on. I just was like, well, that was weird. Okay, what do I got to do today? You know, I just sort of like let it go. Didn't think about it or talk about it for a moment after that. I don't know where I didn't specifically consciously put it anywhere.
You didn't put it in the unexplained box. You just literally left it. Yeah, you passed it up.
Okay. I left it because it wasn't entirely unexplained. It wasn't like that. It was real and familiar. But it would be like watching a meteor fly through the sky or something. You'd kind of go, oh. And you kind of know that something fell through the atmosphere. You know, and you may go look up what's a meteor, but, you know, or you just kind of go, wow, that was cool, and you just move on. Mm-hmm. So that was more my thing. That was cool. And then I just moved on. And but what was cool about that was that, you know, as I began to study and read these things, I went, oh, yeah, that's what that was. I'm like, oh, that's what that was.
So it became a signpost on the map for you.
Yeah, later on, it was like, oh, that was big. That was huge. That was a big deal. That's all what right. that was. Oh, my
that
God.
That tells me a lot about who you were at that particular time. You were a pretty now-centered person. That didn't impact you and throw you off balance. Meaning some people might go, oh, I need to get some help or I need to reach out to somebody. No, you were like, that's all right. I can deal with that and move through it.
I was that way since a baby. I was like the coolest kid to anyone, you know,
cool my cucumber. Uncles.
It just, yeah, I would just sit there. Not much would faze me. I literally was like, I had a reputation at like 4 or 3 that I just sat there and watched.
That points me already to what you said earlier and how you describe what you do. You're a witness, right? So that potential was there already.
But to answer the question, really, it was, you know, it was being a kind of skeptical, I don't know how I would say it, but sort of like not easily falling or being pulled into, not drinking, you know, I wasn't a Kool-Aid drinker, right? I don't know how else to say it, but I was the kind that would just kind of sit back and go, okay, yeah, I don't know about that. But it required a kind of big, obvious thing. So what happened was.
All right, folks, that's a wrap. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a review on whatever platform you're listening to. This just helps put it in the hands of the people likely to get something out of it. If you'd like to dig a little deeper and see what we got cooking here at TUI Media, you can visit our website at tuimedia.com. Wishing you grace to fill your sails today. Stay great in the meantime, and I'll see you on the next Pioneers of Insight.
What I've learned over the years is that there's an easy way and a hard way to do everything.